Good morning. How's everyone doing? Let's start with sitting quietly for a couple of minutes. So if you're on a cushion, please find a position that's good for meditating, where you can hold your back nice and straight, not rigidly, but nice and straight. Hi, come on in. We have a couple of spots in here yet. If someone would like to come in here, we have a chair over here, a couple of chairs over here. We have a couple of cushions also. So, yeah, are there any more spots over here? Okay, there are a couple of cushions over here if you'd like to take a cushion. There's one here and one here. And are we running out of chairs out there? Okay, all right. So we're going to sit quietly for a few minutes. If you're sitting in a chair, please put your feet flat on the floor and place your hands like this, the way we do it in our tradition. Right hand on the bottom, left hand on the top, thumb tips touching. So you're making a little orb there, a little circle. Rest your hands in your lap. Hold your back straight. And notice your breathing. And bring a very soft focus to your breathing. You may hear other sounds, that's okay. You can put a little bit of your attention on those other sounds. Put most of your attention right here on your breathing. If thoughts come, let them go. Gently come back to your breathing. All right, thank you. So, the title of this talk this morning is Learning to Work, Part 2. I gave Part 1 a few weeks ago. I'm sure some of you were here. I told some stories from my childhood about learning to work, about the types of things I did growing up on a farm, things like selling greeting cards in town, raising chickens, hoeing sugar beets, all these little jobs I had. And I talked about how we all have to learn to work in a conventional way. We have to get the job done. We have to achieve the results. But once we grow up, the conventional way of working can actually be quite inconsistent with our Zen practice. Quite inconsistent with being in the moment and taking care of what's in front of us. And ultimately, it is helpful if we unlearn how to work in that conventional way and learn to work in a way in which we have much more presence, much more harmony with our work. And if we're able to do that, it's really not working at all. It's just being. So being at work does not have to be something that's outside of our Zen practice. Work can be at the very heart of our Zen practice. It is our Zen practice. I said last time, we learn about attachment and control and giving up control and how, ironically, giving up control gives us a measure of peace. So it's about a kind of opening. It's about a kind of giving up control in the moment and letting the moment be. And that's kind of the opposite of the conventional way, because the conventional way is to try to have control at all times. This morning I'd like to talk a little bit about these two different ways of experiencing work. Then I'd like to focus on some jobs we have here at Zen Center and how doing a job at Zen Center can be a means of helping you with your practice. Then finally, I'm going to tell a story about an experience I had doing a Zen Center job on a retreat and how it helped me in my practice. So first, these two different ways of experiencing work. I think I can think of three different ways to describe our conventional attitudes toward work. And I'm going to talk about those briefly, along with a bit about how the Zen approach is different. So the first thing, the conventional attitude toward work is that we have attachment to results, right? We have attachment to results. And this is true about many things in our lives, not just about work. And about everything I'm saying this morning applies to many different things other than work. But that's what I'm focusing on. So we have this attachment to results. We want something so badly that it motivates us. And I told this story last time about how I was really young and I was maybe 7 or 8 years old, and I talked my mom into letting me sell greeting cards door to door in town. And she didn't think that was really proper, but I begged her because I had seen this. I got this magazine and it had this big ad about how you could do this and you could earn some money. And if you did this, it was a baseball themed ad. You could also get a picture of a baseball player, Mickey Mantle, which was signed. And he was my hero. And I wanted that so badly. I was so attached to the results, you know. And as it turned out, I forgot to put something in the envelope and I ended up not getting the picture. So that was a really rough introduction to the world of work. But the point here is the motivation, wanting something really badly. It's a big part of our attitude toward work. We're motivated by the results, the reward, which can be money, or it can just be the satisfaction of a job well done. And how often have you said to yourself, doing a job, I don't like this, this is really unpleasant, but it's okay because when I'm done, I'm going to get that thing that I really want and I'll get something nice in the end. And this helps us in our work to be motivated by what we're going to get, but things can go wrong. We can tend to overvalue the reward, and that's kind of what attachment is, overvaluing the reward. We can ascribe to the reward qualities it isn't really capable of having. We get too focused on it. If I can just get that new car, then I'll really be happy. You know, every part of my life will be okay. If I can just get that promotion, everyone will respect me, and I'll be happy all the time. And then we get the thing, and we're still not totally happy. And we go, what went wrong? Well, maybe we didn't get the right thing. Maybe we need a bigger thing. Maybe we need a bigger car. Maybe we need a bigger promotion. And this can go on and on. It's kind of this endless cycle of desire and attempted fulfillment of desire. So this cycle is quite different from our Zen practice. In Zen practice, we don't keep our eyes on the reward. That's not what motivates us. When we are meditating, for example, we cannot think about results because that will prevent us from experiencing the moment. We may show up here at Zen Center with expectations. We may want to improve ourselves or become more focused or become less anxious or less angry. We may want to find some kind of peace or calm. We may want to become enlightened. And that's fine if it gets us in the door. That's fine that we're motivated by those things. We may be continued to be motivated by those things as our practice continues, and that's okay. These are really fine aspirations. But on the cushion or on the chair, where we're meditating, in the moment of meditating, thinking about results is just not helpful. And it kind of sabotages our meditation. Because meditation is really about opening up. It's about opening up to this moment. Now, in the beginning, especially when we're meditating, we focus extensively on our breath. So we kind of have something going on there. We're kind of doing something. We're bringing ourselves back to the breath over and over. We're kind of aware when our mind goes off, and we're bringing it back. So we've got a little mental involvement there. But as time goes on, ultimately, we give up all of that stuff. All of that stuff, and it's about just being. It's about just being completely open to this moment and not knowing what's going to come in, not having any idea. So by definition, we cannot possibly be thinking about results or the future. So we have to unlearn focusing on the future. We have to learn to sit just to sit and to work just to work. So before I go on to the other two things, I'd like to interject something here because I don't want to be misunderstood. I'm not suggesting that in our work we need to always let go of the future, that expectations, thinking about the future, thinking about a reward is something that is the enemy and must be destroyed, and we can never do that. If we were to forget about the future entirely, that would be disastrous. I mean, if we're at work and we're on a big project, we can't say, well, I'm only going to take care of what's in front of me and I'm not going to think about the result at all because I'm a good Zen practitioner. That's not going to work. You have to keep the result in mind and you have to keep adjusting what you're doing in order to keep the result, to keep yourself moving toward the result you need, and that may be a moving result. We have to use that planning function, even jobs here in Zen Center. So we can't always be in the moment. Sometimes we have to be intensely focused. We have to keep the future in mind. So sometimes we need that conventional way of approaching things. Sometimes, however, we can work without indulging that thinking part of our brain. The thing is, it's a matter of balance. It's a matter of the middle path. And I'm stressing the non-thinking part because that's what most of us have a lot to learn about, the non-thinking part, because we tend to let that thinking part take over. If we had a lot to learn about the thinking part, I would be stressing that. If we were all too much in the moment so that nothing was getting accomplished and rain was coming in the roof and everything because we're too much on the moment, then I would stress thinking. But that's not the problem most of us have. So the second way we can describe our conventional approach to work, sometimes we have an intense focus on the task at hand to the exclusion of everything else, because we need to get the job done. We might ignore physical pain. We might ignore psychological pain. We might ignore all of the consequences of what we're doing, even the bad consequences, because we have to get the job done. And you know this. You've done this. I'm going to make the big push here, and I don't care if I get tired, and I don't care if I ignore everything else. I don't care if everything else falls apart. I have got to get this job done, and that's all there is to it. Sometimes we simply need to do this thing. And this is different from the focus we bring to our Zen practice because it's a partial, incomplete focus. It's kind of dividing our world and saying that only part of our world exists, only the part that's right in front of me, and I'm going to take care of that and let everything else go. Whereas I think the kind of attention we bring to things with our Zen practice does not exclude anything. It lets everything in. Everything in, good, bad, or indifferent. So, we're with whatever comes up in our Zen practice. The third way we can describe our conventional approach to work is we learn to always think and plan ahead. Hi. So, thinking and planning ahead. I'm not talking about reward here. I already talked about that. I'm talking about how we need to get the job done. So if we get a few quiet moments on our job, we'll probably use them to engage in thought and planning because we're trying to be incredibly efficient, right? We don't want to waste any time. So I've got a few moments here, and what I'm going to do is sort of revise my plan. Now, this is perfectly okay, and it's even necessary at times, but the point is we can get a little carried away with this too, and it can become habitual. We get a few quiet moments in our job, and we're sort of immediately thinking things over when maybe we don't need to, when maybe we could be using those few moments to say, hey, I've got a few moments here. I'm going to totally concentrate on what it's like for my pencil to touch the paper here, or what it's like to feel my fingers on the keyboard, or what it's like to breathe, or what it's like to eat my lunch. Instead, it's like, I don't have time to eat my lunch. And it's just habitual. You know what? Sometimes you do have time to eat your lunch. So we're unable to just be. Our brain just kind of compulsively kicks in. So that's another thing that we have to kind of unlearn, that sort of compulsive thinking that prevents us from getting a few quiet moments during our workday. So to really enjoy our work, we need to bring our Zen practice into our work life. And how is it that that happens? Well, occasionally it happens spontaneously. And when it does, it's good to pay attention to that. It's probably not really spontaneous. It's probably because we've been making a great effort of some kind. But it seems spontaneous when it happens. And I talked about one of those moments in my last talk. My first real job was at a plant nursery. I was 16 or 17 years old. And I remember one day, this was over 40 years ago, but I still remember this afternoon because it was something new and different that I hadn't really experienced before. And I remember, I guess I was building something because I was at a pile of scrap lumber and I was picking out lumber that I needed for this project. And I think it started with kind of pretending to that my work really, really, really mattered. And somehow the pretending became the reality. And I realized that there was something, it's subtle and it's hard to describe, but there was something about, in this moment, having a kind of relaxed attention to this moment and totally doing this thing now and not having any other moment at this time. It's as if time stopped. I'm totally in this moment, totally confident that the next moment is going to come along and that will be something else and that will be different. This moment is not going to carry forward. So it was kind of a complete relaxation. And it was kind of being, really being one with my work, moment after moment. And this happens to all of us sometimes. You know, we tend not to realize it because the thing is, the realizing part of ourself isn't there. That's why it's happening. So there was this kind of quiet joy about it, you know, quiet joy. And perhaps for me, that was the beginning of unlearning to work. And it wasn't until years later when I came to a Zen center for the first time that I learned that we can actually cultivate this unlearning. It's not something that just may happen spontaneously on rare occasions when we're lucky, that we can do this through Zen practice. Now, Zen practice, which we do here, is tried and true, and it's been refined over hundreds of years. And it's based on meditation. And meditation, as I said, is ultimately really about just being, letting each moment be completely as it is with no intervention on our part. Which means that we're not there. We can't bring something to it and want something from it or look for something here. We can only be completely open. We can only be absent. Absence of Ted is doing this meditation. And we're open and we see what happens. And Zen practice is set up so that we can bring this openness to other tasks. Meditation is not the only thing we do here. One thing we do, if you come early in the morning or in the afternoon during the week, we'll have two periods of meditation. And between those two periods, we'll have Kinhin, which is walking meditation. And this I like to think of as a bit of a bridge between meditation and doing stuff here in the real world, because it's an activity. During walking meditation, you maintain your focus. You really maintain your meditation. If you note that your mind is going off, you let the thought go and you come back to your breathing. Except now it's breathing and walking, probably coordinated. I take a step each time I exhale. So you're doing two things together. So these are like baby steps, almost literally, out here in the real world. And then there are other things we do as well. We do a service in the morning after our two sittings, and this is a little more complicated. We have things that we do during the service. We'll do a gassho, a simple bow. We'll do a more extended bow. We do chanting. We do various things. So this is another bridge. It's a little more complicated. And then there are the jobs here at Zen Center. There are many volunteer jobs, and that's what I'd like to focus on now. And they're not just about getting the work done. It's not just about keeping the place running, although we love to keep the place running. They're on that continuum of simple to complicated ways that you can do work and still be mindful. Here we have just sitting, and then we have kinhin, and then we have service, and then we have some of these complicated jobs like Mino or something. And I think the epitome is probably board practice, because that's the hardest thing to do and still be mindful. But you can do it. People do it all the time. So I remember my first task at a Zen center when I showed up at the Zen center in Ann Arbor, and I think it was on Buddha's birthday, and I had a little time between events, and I asked if I could help out. And there was a guy there, I think he was probably a priest in training, and he said, sure, you can help with weeding. And I said, great. So I went in the backyard, and he gave me a little instruction. And the instruction was, don't work too hard, you know, just weed. Don't worry about it too much. Don't worry about the results. Just do the work. And I thought that was great instruction. I knew it wasn't just about getting the job done. Of course, it's partially about that. And our jobs here at Zen Center are partially about that. If you're new to Zen Center, you may not suspect this, but it takes a lot of people to keep things going here. And most of the labor we rely on is by volunteers. And I'm going to mention a few of the jobs here. I'll probably leave some out, so I apologize in advance if I leave your job out. But just on Sunday, we have a greeter. You may have met the greeter when you came in, which is Darla today. We have a doan, which is Steve today, and that person keeps time, makes the announcements, does some other important stuff. We have a tea cook who prepares the food. We have a person teaching the introduction upstairs, and we have the lecturer. So we have these five formal jobs, and maybe I'm leaving some out, I don't know. And then we have a lot of other people who are just kind of around keeping an eye on things. So it doesn't just happen. And then we have various jobs that involve a one-year term. And some of them are actually 2 years, because you have to spend a year learning how to do the job as an assistant before you get to do the job. And one of those is Eno, and that is the person who kind of watches over everything, almost everything, all of the scheduling and all of the teaching, and it's a huge job. Our Eno is Stacy, who is not here today. She's on a well-earned vacation. We have a Tenzo, who is our cook. We have a Chidin, who is in charge of ceremonial stuff. We have a work leader who assigns jobs during retreats and work days. We have building maintenance people, grounds maintenance people. We have the board. We have our teachers. We have a leadership group consisting of 6 teachers who have made a special commitment to administration and other kinds of leadership. We have a sign-up sheet behind this wall and toward the back of the building where anybody can sign up and get into this program, which is run by Mark Turbeck, and do a volunteer task, which could be cleaning or some kind of maintenance or something like that, and that's very helpful stuff. We have people who handle the recordings and the archives of recordings that go back about 40 years, maybe, and we have the Katagiri Project on the website, which is coordinated by Andrea Martin. We have doans for the sittings during the week and on Saturdays. We have people who coordinate and teach at the various programs, like Dharma Family Sundays, Tuesday night gatherings. We have a librarian. We have outreach people. We do Habitat for Humanity. We do Joyce Food Shelf. We do teaching at a juvenile detention center. There's a lot of stuff going on here. It's a pretty impressive list. And then we have short-term jobs as well, which may last an hour or a day. If you sign up for a retreat, you may get assigned a job. If it's your very first retreat, your most likely job will be dishwashing. And you're lucky if you get that, because that's a great job, because it's pretty easy to maintain your focus. I shouldn't say easy. It could be the biggest challenge in the world to maintain your focus while doing dishes. But it can be a great opportunity to practice that focus. So, and if you've done a few retreats, you might become a server. You might serve food in kind of a formal day, or way, I mean. After you've done quite a few retreats, you could end up coordinating the food services, servers, or maybe you could be the doan and keep time all day and lead chants. And at the first retreat, you may not be able to imagine yourself doing those jobs because they're heavy with tradition and they're very complicated, and you think, sitting is hard enough. How could I possibly add a job like that to it? But the time comes where you really surprise yourself, and that time could come much sooner than you think. So it's really astonishing how many people come together to make all this happen. It's a really wonderful illustration of the principle of interdependence, and it's something we're all grateful for. I'm incredibly grateful to all of these folks who make it possible to share this practice with anyone who comes here and wants to learn this practice. So people sign up for these jobs because they want the place to run smoothly, because they want to give back. They have a sense of gratitude, and so they want to help. But it's much more than that. It is, these jobs are training. For one thing, they're about engaging mindfully. If you come here on a work day and you're working with a group of people, you'll probably see that it feels a little different from some of the work you've done. It's quieter. It may be in silence, or it may be partially silent, and people have this kind of soft and beautiful focus, and maybe are just a little more deliberate in the things they do than they usually do. It's wonderful training. And the opportunity to work side by side with people who are truly present is a great thing. And it's so subtle you might not even see it for a while. But eventually you will. But taking on a job at Zen Center is much more than mindfulness even. Taking responsibility for something that might feel a little bit intimidating. Something you may not quite feel ready for is a way to deepen your practice. It's a way to give up control a little bit, to throw yourself into something, to take a risk. Taking a risk, abandoning the safe route, is an essential part of Zen practice. Taking a risk is an essential part of Zen practice. On your cushion and in your life, at some point you have to hurl yourself into the unknown and give up what is safe. If you're going to learn to fully function in a world that is not always safe and is not under your control. I know it sounds scary, but it's true. And if you come to Zen practice thinking that you will maintain control every step of the way and only do the part that's safe, you're going to find that it's very difficult to deepen your practice. So if you're playing it safe, if your practice seems stalled, make a commitment. Give up control. Jump in where you are fearful, really. You know this, right? You know that when you really grow spiritually and as a person, it's because you're willing to do something you're a little scared of doing. And here, you can do the scary stuff in a safe environment, if that makes any sense. You have a lot of support. You have to do it alone, but you have a lot of support. So I'd like to give you an example from something that happened to me quite a few years ago when I was fairly new to this practice. And I told this story once before. I don't know if it was on a Sunday. I think it was quite a long time ago. But I was asked to tell it again. Wanda, one of the priests here, asked me to tell this again. And she actually suggested the topic for this this thought, and I'm grateful to her for that. She's not here today. She's off doing a 30-day retreat. But so when I first came here, I think it was about 21 years ago, it was after my year in Ann Arbor. And there were two things I had heard about that are really important to Zen practice, and I was hesitant to do both of those. And the first was to work with a teacher, closely with a teacher, one-on-one. I was a little intimidated by that, and it took me a while. I finally overcame that and worked very closely with a teacher. The other was I was hesitant to do a retreat. And I remember having one of those porch conversations with someone. I don't remember who, but I was saying, yeah, there's this Labor Day retreat coming up, and it's at Hokyoji, this monastery in southeast Minnesota that I've never been to, way out in the country, and it's a three-day retreat, and I don't really know what they do at retreats, and I don't know if I want to do it. And the person said to me, one of those great words of wisdom, if you're not ready now, when will you be ready? And that really struck me, because the point is, at some point, you have to do it now, right? At some point, it does not become something off in the future. It's just something you have to do right now. And I thought, yeah, okay, this can be now, and I will sign up. So I made that leap. And I did my first weekend retreat at Hokyoji. I think it was 1993. I drove down there. I slept in a tent. It was one of the hardest things I ever did and one of the best things I ever did. And I was hooked, and I've been doing them since. And then the next summer, I think it was, I signed up for my first week-long retreat at Hokyoji. This was led by Shohaku Okamura when he was interim teacher here. I think it was probably 1994. And at that time, there was this week-long retreat that took place every summer in June. Do you remember these, Rosemary? Yeah, and there were people that came from all over, people from Kansas and Indiana, and it was kind of a tight group, and it was a pretty full zendo, and there was a lot of tradition, and they really knew what they were doing, and I was pretty new at this. It was very formal, and I was filled with energy the first few days, really filled with energy, and I had a lot of expectations. I was thinking about the future. I was thinking about the reward. I'll become enlightened at last in 3 days. Hope it doesn't take all 3 days, you know. And so it became very difficult, right? Because those expectations, they'll wear you down during retreat. You know, it's like, how come I'm not happy yet? You know? And by about the fifth day, I was really worn down. Really worn down, sad to say. And I think, you know, I have to reconstruct this story a little bit because it was so long ago, but I think I was probably not really following my breath. I think I was probably sitting on my cushion, letting my mind run wild, indulging it, letting it go anywhere that would give me a little relief from the present moment, you know. Thinking about how miserable I was, thinking about how much better things would be when I got home. And it was so bad, I might have left, except I had given another guy a ride down there, so I couldn't leave. So I learned my lesson. Don't give somebody a ride. So I do better at retreats now, I want you to know. But so at the end of the fifth day, I think it was around dinner time, I look at the work list for the next day, kind of hoping and praying my name won't be on there. And I look at it, and I see my name on there next to the word Jikido. And my heart sank. And I felt kind of panicky. Because Jikido, here we have a position called Jikido, which is a kind of a temple cleaning position. Down there it was something much different. Jikido was very much like Doan here. You don't lead the chants, but you do all of the timekeeping for the day. So you ring the bell, three bells to start meditation, one at the end if you're not doing walking meditation, two at the end if you are doing walking meditation. You hit the wooden block, 10 and then 5 minutes before meditation. There's this complicated thing you go out and do early in the morning where you ring a bell multiple times. You're responsible for the zendo, so you have to make sure the fans are running when it's hot and the lamps are lit when they're supposed to be. So it was this huge amount of detail. And I realized that I would have to have really good focus all day, the entire day, from probably about 5:30 a.m. to 9 o'clock at night, continually. I would not have a break. And here I was. I was just a puddle. And I thought, I don't know if I can do this. I don't think I could do this. And I thought, well, you know, I could tell them I can't do this. And they would probably let me out. And I didn't do that. Somehow, I didn't do that. I said, okay, I'm going to do this. Okay, how do I possibly get ready for this? And I think I had kind of an instinct as to what I needed to do. And I don't think I even articulated it to myself. But I knew that thinking about it would not help. I could go over it again and again in my mind, all of the things I had to do, and sort of memorize it and make sure I had it right. But I had an instinct that told me that that would just sort of add to this unfortunate mental activity. So I knew what I had to do was I had to just be present with whatever was in front of me. That's what I needed to do. Because on my cushion, I had been off every place but here. Every place but the miserable place that was here. So I had to bring myself back. So I had a little time. And at some point, I got some training. There were these two guys who had been Jeet Kune Do, and they kind of told me what to do. They were very helpful, very kind, and that was good. And so what I did was I went back to my tent. And I took a look inside my tent, and I saw that everything was kind of in disorder. There were piles of clothes all over the place. This was the fifth day. There was a lot of grass in there because I brought it in on my shoes. So the first thing I did was I took most of the things out of my tent and put them outside, and I very carefully swept the tent and got every little bit of grass out of there and decided from now on I will not bring in more grass. I'll carefully take off my shoes before I go into the tent. And I brought my stuff back in and I arranged it neatly and I folded the clothes. And I saw that I had a little Buddha there that I had brought down with me and put in my tent, and he was just kind of sitting on the bottom of the tent. And I thought, well, you know, I could do that better. I could find an altar. So I went over to the wood pile, and I found a log, and I looked at the logs, and I found one that would make a really nice altar. I brought that in. I put the Buddha on there. I found something to use for a vase. I went out and got some flowers and put in there and put those there. So now I had a neat tent, and I had a nice vase, and I did three bows to the Buddha, three full bows to the Buddha, and okay. Kind of keeping in mind there's this big thing tomorrow. But a real soft focus on that, no planning at all. All that was, knowing that big thing was off there, was a little bit of a motivation, a soft motivation to come back here. But when that comes in, oh yeah, big thing tomorrow, it's not, okay, now I have to think about the big thing. It's, no, I have to come back to this. I have to come back to this. So I maintained that. I took a little walk, and then the two evening sittings occurred, and I did those sittings just maintaining that. And also watching the Jeet Kune Do very carefully because I knew I would have to do this. And I think I probably maintained my focus even in my sleep a little bit because I thought this is going to take everything I've got, right? And in this little world of retreat, that becomes very big. Like, this is it. I got to do this thing. So the next morning I woke up and I set up the Zendo. And people started coming in, and I did the first bell of the day, opened the meditation, closed it, and then it was time to go out. They did this really beautiful, complicated thing in the morning where I would go out. There's this bell at Hokyoji, which is outdoors. It has a little roof on it, kind of this freestanding bell. And I went out there, and at a certain time, I needed to ring it 18 times 30 seconds apart. And each time you ring it, you move a rock so you know how many times you've done that. And then during the 30 seconds, you're simply there with your breath. And before you do that, of course, you bow to the bell three times. And when you're done, you bow to the bell three times. Then after that, there's all the breakfast stuff. And there are bells and things at the kitchen. And we answer them from over here, you know, and it's all this beautiful stuff. And I did that. I didn't let my mind wander. I went throughout the day. I lit the lamps. I did all that stuff. And then at the end of the day, finally, we do a chant, Fukan Zazengi. And it's time to ring the doshi out. So four bells, first bell, second bell, third bell, bow to the altar, fourth bell, and the doshi goes out. And those two guys that had trained me, they come rushing over to me, and they're like, you did it, you did it. Every single bell all day was exactly at the right time. And these guys were so sweet. Talk about sympathetic joy. They were happier than if they had done it themselves. They were so happy for me. And I felt this really quiet joy, this really quiet happiness. You know, not like I climbed to the top of the mountain, woohoo, not that kind of joy, but just this quiet joy. I was able to do this thing. I was able to serve these people. And I think it was transformative. I mean, I was able to really turn things around through my own efforts. To go from being a total mess to being able to do these, to do this thing. Because I was willing to do it. Because I made the commitment. You know, I was willing to throw myself into the void. So, I think it was transformative. I have used that since. I mean, that's what I do now when I prepare for a big event. And I'm going to give away some of my secrets here. If I prepare for a big event, like a ceremony that I'm conducting, or a Dharma talk, something that I really have to be on, I find that half of it is the preparation. And that is essential. You have to know how to conduct a ceremony. You have to practice it. You have to work out all the details and say, okay, who's going to stand where? You have to talk to people. If you're doing a Dharma talk, you've got to write the thing. You've got to be prepared. You have to do that part. But the other half is, who are you when you show up to do the thing? And that is equally important. Who are you when you show up to do the thing? Are you there or not? If you've done your preparation and you're still wrapped up in your preparation when you get there, and you're still in that kind of preparing mode, and you're still trapped in all that mental activity, then you're not in the moment. And if something happens, it's going to throw you off, you know, and you're not going to really be there. So we should be grateful for the things that throw us off, really, because they help us to come to the moment. So there are really three steps here in taking on a job. And the first is the commitment. I'll do this job no matter what it takes, even if I'm scared. Then there's the preparation. Sometimes the preparation is extensive, writing the talk. Sometimes the job you're going to do is more simple. Maybe the preparation is something simple. Maybe it's just turning off the radio on your way to Zen Center so you can concentrate a little more. Maybe it's just bringing yourself to the moment. But there's that preparation. And then the third thing is the doing, which is all about being in the moment. And it's the commitment that I'm really focusing on today. And I would like to encourage you, if you've been coming to Zen Center for quite a long time, consider taking on a volunteer job. Talk to the Eno, sign up out here on the bulletin board, something like that. Talk to people and just see what needs to be done here. Make that leap. Of course, it doesn't have to happen at Zen Center. I mean, there are many realms in your life where you can do this, where you can take on something that you're a little afraid of. I remember once taking on something, working with a troubled kid, and it transformed my life because I was willing to really make that commitment. And I was scared to death. And I wouldn't be here if I hadn't done that thing, I believe, because it opened my heart. It opened my heart. So, you know, maybe you've been coming to retreats for a while and haven't taken on a job. You know, have you ever thought about being Doan, training to be Doan, kind of jumping into that? It's something you can keep in your mind. So any time in your life you make that scary leap, just remember, you're making that leap. The things you do, the way that's going to transform you, it's going to affect people around you. You are making that leap with all beings and for all beings. Your commitment to the practice is going to benefit them all. So I would encourage that. And that's what I have to say this morning about work. And if anyone has a comment or perhaps a question, I'd be open to that. Yes? Ah.
When you were given that assignment on do you think it was your teacher that knew that would be something that you could have
been? You know, I wondered about that. It wouldn't have been the guiding teacher that would have assigned that. It would have been the Eno, and I remember the Eno, and he seemed like a really skillful guy. And I just wonder. I mean, he'd been practicing a long time. And did he kind of see how I was struggling and think it could help him to have this job? It may have been skillful means on his part, and it may have been random. But the point is, assigning a job like that can help someone. Thanks, that's a good question. Yes?
Can you speak more about the balance? At the beginning, we were talking about being in the moment and being present, but then also not forgetting about the future. Can you talk about how to be skillful in that balance?
Right. The question is about being skillful in following the middle way, in balancing these two ways of working. If you're doing something like sweeping the path, it's pretty easy. You don't really have to think about the future at all. You can just sweep. If you're doing something like replacing the boards on the porch out here, there's some planning involved. And I think the thing is to not get too wrapped up in the planning, to give the planning its proper place, you know. Now it's time to plan and to measure and to think, and I'm going to step back and do that. And once I've sort of made my decision about what board I need, I can let that go, and I can come back to seeing the board, feeling the board, you know, knowing what's going on here. I don't need to carry that with me. And it's when that kind of attention, focus, becomes habit energy that you're in trouble. When it's habit energy, it's going to stay with you no matter what, whether it's helpful or not. And pretty soon it becomes unnecessary mental activity. So kind of, you know, thinking when it's time to think and letting it go when it's time to let go. And if you feel that habit energy happening, you can do something consciously. Okay, I'm going to follow my breath for a little while now as I do this to kind of interrupt that cycle. Now, it gets even more complicated if you're at work and you're writing something on your computer, you know, and that's intensely left brain. And it's so easy to get just carried off, and there's just no idea of being in the moment because of, there's all that planning. But you really can find ways to bring yourself back to the moment during the course of your day, you know, during lunch, when you go to get a drink, or you can just stop and do some breathing for a little while. It's not easy, but you can do that. And if you're really focused, if you're really able to do that, you can find that you can actually do that in the midst of the left brain activity. And that's the hardest thing. But you can be mindful about left brain activity. Something about, I don't know, not letting the thoughts fly off necessarily, kind of keeping some presence there. The thing that's happening, the mental activity, that's not you. You're a little apart from that mental activity. You know, you're there, and it's there. So it is a challenge. But basically, we practice it in very simple settings and gradually bring it into more difficult settings, I would say. Thanks for the question. Yes?
Would you say that you would take the same approach if you're like, what if you're planning like a kind of a larger excursion that's like, you know, maybe like 4 months down the road, like if you're planning on taking a vacation or like a longer retreat that's not really, you know, in the now, like you're not, I guess all you can do in the now is to actually plan for something that's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the same approach? Like while you're planning it, you're planning it, and then, you know, you make that time to just have the differences between planning it and then just not planning it.
I think so. I think that makes sense. And there's planning it, and in the early stages, your planning can be pretty loose, too, and it could almost be like sort of fantasizing about what might happen, because that could actually be helpful, because that opens you to possibilities. Oh, I could do this. I could go to this place, which I had never thought of. So it's kind of this wide-open planning, and you kind of let yourself go there, which I think could be really helpful, you know. And hopefully not let it sort of, sometimes when we plan a big thing, it sort of, it becomes going over the stuff too much in a way that's not helpful. You know, if you go over the train schedule once and then you check it a second time, that's great. Third and fourth time, well, you're probably getting a little too wrapped up in it, so it's time to let it go. Yes, Kate?
Yeah, I can kind of speak to that. Because when we're going to cook for a rojasa, for example, which will be one, you know, there's the general planning, there's the specific planning, and then there's the going to the store and seeing what they're planning, and then there's the, and so there are all these layers of planning, and you have to sort of be able to say, well, I'm not going to know what I'm going to do here because until I get to the store and I see what's there. So then you have to kind of let go of that. And then use that sentence more. And then there's the, okay, we're here and we're halfway through the week and now what do I have left over? And what are people eating and not eating? And there's the reshuffling of the, So then all of a sudden there's new layer. So it's like you have to keep coming back there, but it should be, it's that coming back and being in the planning place and then letting it go. It's a layer.
Yeah, thanks. That's a good example. Maybe one more comment? Yeah.
It's not more of a question. Definitely a question. Projects with a lot of interdependence. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah. That's a big subject, and I don't know if I can give you a quick answer. I could recommend a book. There's a book called Awake at Work by Michael Carroll. And it's all about sort of accepting that work is a mess and letting go of the things you need to let go of and taking control of the things you can take control of. And other folks are like that. You know, you have to let go of a lot because you can't change them. And you have to kind of know, well, what can I say that will be helpful? How can I do it skillfully? What do I do when someone is just impossible? When do I need to confront a person? Because sometimes then people have to do that as much as they dislike it. So, thanks for the question. But that's the best answer I can come up with right now.